Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Marky.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing all right.
I'm glad.
Feeling a little bizarre.
Why are you feeling a little bizarre? Oh, I know, because of our next guest.
You're so good at this.
Yeah, we have Andrew Zimmern coming on. His show is called Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern, where he eats all kinds of weird stuff.
You know, we're going to talk about this with him in a few minutes on the show, but I just have to say, this guy last week was on The Tonight Show, and he brought some bizarre foods onto the show. He got Jay Leno to eat chicken feet. He got Jay Leno to eat haggis. Okay, it was very impressive story, and what he did to Felicity Huffman, which we'll talk about later, was just remarkable.
Do you know what I like about being Irish?
What's that?
Of all the Celtic cultures, we don't have haggis.
You skipped haggis.
Scottish. That's not Irish.
But Leno seemed to enjoy it. Actually, yeah. The chicken feet he was really going at. The barbecue chicken feet.
Bully for him. I have to say, in the realm of foods that some people consider bizarre, and it's really unusual in our culture, even within our culture, there are segments that don't eat certain things and do eat other things. When you start talking about going into a Chinese or a Japanese restaurant or visiting China or Japan or other Asian countries, they eat things that we would find just because we have a cultural bias against them.
Well, even other parts of this country eat very differently than we here in the Northeast.
I actually am very excited because I have scheduled a vacation.
I'm very excited that you've scheduled a vacation as well.
Leave you alone. I'm going to... a friend of mine from Ireland is actually flying in and going to pick up a motorcycle in Missoula, Montana. So I sold my motorcycle here, and I am also buying a motorcycle in Missoula, Montana. We're going to take our Harley-Davidsons, and we're going to go down to... Do you remember the two women we had, Blake and Jen, from Hell's Backbone Grill?
Hell's Backbone Grill, exactly.
Which is a restaurant in
Boulder,
Utah. Most difficult to get to town in America. You can't get there in the wintertime. It's the most isolated town in America. Received regular mail by mule train until 1949. So we're going to ride our bikes down there. We're going to go to that restaurant. I'll bring some recording equipment with me, and hopefully we'll have some food adventures along the way.
That's great.
But I'm reminded of something called... Do you remember this? There's something called prairie butter.
I don't recall what prairie butter was.
There's a restaurant from Texas that opened up, and they serve what they call prairie butter, which I believe is the bone marrow. But what they do is they take the femur of a buffalo, and they cut it, and they roast it, and then cut it in half, and serve the two sides with the marrow exposed, and the bone marrow is called prairie butter.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I'm sure there are certain cultures that would look at us like we had two heads because we're eating bone marrow. I'm sure there's people listening to the show right this minute who are thinking, they eat bone marrow?
I'm sure there are people who were listening to the show until a minute ago and they heard me say that, and then they turn it off. Now, bone marrow I love. I actually, to tie this all together in one big pretty knot.
I was hoping you were going to do that.
Here it comes. I had a dinner party at my house, very small dinner party. We had another couple over, and we served the grass-fed steaks that we have. We took them from the restaurant. We have some grass, tall grass farms, grass-fed... painted grass farms.
Grass-fed
beef, and we had some steaks from it. Now, there's not as much fat, and it's a different kind of fat that's in grass-fed beef as opposed to corn-fed beef.
Mm-hmm.
Very flavorful. You can't cook it more than medium rare, and it was delicious. But one of the things I had the chef do, and he does this at the restaurant, is he sent up some marrow bones, some sections of bone, so that I seared the steaks on the stove in a cast iron pan. But then I serve them with the marrow, because I roasted the marrow bones to get that all, and I basically spread it on, like, took the marrow out of the bones. Sorry.
Like prairie butter.
Like prairie butter is what I was thinking of, which I hope to have when I'm out in Montana. But I took it, and I took the marrow, and I just spread it on top of the steak, And it gives you a great sense of richness that can sometimes people miss in grass-fed beef. Because grass-fed beef has more flavor, but it has maybe less richness than a corn-fed steak.
For a lot of you home cooks out there, one of the things, why do you put those beef bones, why do you put those things into your gravy or tomato sauce or whatever you're putting all those bones into, those things that you're long cooking, into your soups, into the things you're roasting?
Right.
The reason is because what you're doing is you're slow cooking out that marrow. You're slow cooking out the insides of the bones, which is, there's so much flavor and
texture.
Fattiness. And yeah, exactly. And that's why you're putting those bones in there. And honestly, for me, the texture of marrow itself, I find a little off-putting.
I love it.
But the flavor of marrow is spectacular. So that's, I love when the flavors appear in things without the texture.
But how the texture affects, say, a sauce, or the texture affects, like when it's on the steak and it's blended in, it still adds a richness that's sort of unidentifiable. I like it just plain myself. There's a place I go to called Blue Ribbon in Manhattan, where they have had on the menu for a long time. You can get it's basically a marrow jam, I think they call it, and it's basically
I don't remember the exact name, but yes, it's basically
a marmalade, basically, and it's marrow on toast, and you spread it on toast, and it's actually quite delicious.
Especially at 4 a.m, which is when we usually go to Blue Ribbon. Okay,
it's
so
true.
You need to tell the whole story.
A duck sandwich and some marrow toast. That's pretty good when you've had a few, or more than a few. But what Mark brings up a good point is one of the things I enjoy, and I started cooking at home just a little bit more. Not as much as before I owned a restaurant, but I started cooking at home more. And one of the things that I love to do is, number one, I like to fill the house with the smells of garlic and onions. I love that. But also, when you're done, I always loved cooking roasts and meat on the bone. First of all, the meat you get is more flavorful. And then when you're done, it doesn't take anything to the next day throw those bones into a stock pot with some herbs and spices and vegetables and just boil it down by half. And you have a nice stock, the beginnings of a nice soup, and you've also filled your house, because I think this is something that's missing in a lot of households today. We don't have the time to cook. And we can sometimes, you know, go to Whole Foods and get good home meal replacements so we can go out to a restaurant. It's great to have leftovers in the fridge,
you know,
but it's also great to have your house
smell like a simmering pot of
cooking.
Soup or stew. Or, you know, I hadn't, until you said it this moment, I hadn't even realized that I missed that.
Oh, yeah.
I totally miss that. My wife doesn't cook very much, and when she does, she's got 4 kids. She's, you know, running all over the place, and she's making relatively quick meals, or I'm cooking when I'm home. But that kind of stock pot on the oven all day long that my mother, I mean, Saturdays and Sundays, my mother would have something on the stoves all day because she worked and she was getting food ready for the entire week.
And there is a great benefit, and it's a very beautiful thing, I think, to fill the house with the smells of cooking. Not so crazy on filling the kitchen with the dishes when I'm done. Learned that this morning after the dinner party when I walked into the living room and I just closed my eyes and made for the door. And
I am such a...
Hopefully the fairies will come and clean it up while I'm gone to work.
Pot and pan maniac. I just use them and use... I must use 17 pans and 14 pots every time I have one of those
parties. Because
you come
from a business where... When you do it at work,
right.
There's a dishwasher who'll clean it for you.
At work, there's a guy who says, oh, I'll take this from you. Okay. And then he goes and he washes it. I love that.
At home, you're that guy. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Andrew Zimmern about his show, Bizarre Food, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Andrew Zimmern. He's a food writer, dining columnist, restaurant critic, radio talk show host, and he's a TV personality. You may know his show, and if you don't, you should. It's called Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. It's one of the highest-rated programs on the Travel Channel, and it airs Monday evenings at 9.
Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. You flatter me. I have way too many jobs.
I know. Well, that, you know, it's funny. That's the abridged version. My research assistant handed me a page. I said, I can't read a page. The show's over by the time we meet them.
You guys should talk. What is it about the modern day, you know, food world, eat-aholic, that, you know, you get that sand in your shoes, and you just end up saying yes to everything? Or is it that, I'm not sure, maybe it's a chicken or the egg thing. I mean, you guys would know. You start in one corner of the business, and you swear that to be successful, you have to devote all your energy to that thing, and the next thing you know, you've got 17 jobs.
It is the culture, I think, of the hospitality business that we want to say yes to everyone.
I think you're right. You know, it's an interesting choice of words that you use, because with my food critic hat on and my dining columnist hat on, one of the things that I'm always talking about in our industry is how so many people seem to have forgotten the word hospitality in the hospitality industry. They end up these days, it's referred to mostly as the restaurant business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a horrible way to look at things. I think the people who are successful in this remember that it is the hospitality business we're in.
There are two conversations that came to mind. One we had just recently with Marco Pierre White, who's a famous chef who announced on our show that he's going to be opening a restaurant in the United States.
Fabulous.
And the other is Danny Meyer, and both of those guys talked about hospitality. Danny Meyer has a formula. He says it's, you know, when he looks for a service staff and what he looks to achieve in a dining room is 49% service, which is getting the things right, and 51% hospitality, which is making you feel great. And Marco Pierre White says, I'm selling a fabulous dining experience, and then I put food on the plate.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, that being said, the food, once it gets there, has got to be good. But and I think a lot of people also forget that. But you're right. I mean, all things being equal, I'm sure you have favorite restaurants where the food isn't that great,
mm-hmm.
the service isn't that great. But gosh, you want to be there when you're not, and when you're leaving there, you wish you could stay longer.
You know, there's a restaurant in Jersey City where I live that my girlfriend and I go to on a fairly regular basis, and every time we go, we think, God, this place is so nice. I just wish they had good food.
But you keep going.
Yeah, they're nice. It's beautiful. They have good beers. But every time we get it, they put the plate in front of us, and we're like, well, not this time. Maybe next time we come.
Those are the places where we all put our other hats on and we start playing that game, that, you know, the Jackie Mason game, multiplying, you know, seats by check average and trying to figure out whether or not these guys are really capable of doing something better and what it might cost them. That's always a fun game.
Actually, I'll be honest with you. What I usually do when I do that math in my head is, how much longer are these guys going to exist?
Restaurant death watch.
Yeah.
And I've taken a lot of grief. In the Twin Cities, you know, everybody is really polite. I mean, you know how you can tell when you're talking to a Minnesota extrovert, don't you? They're looking at your shoes while they're talking to you. And you know, it's you know, I'm a born and bred New Yorker and moved here 15 years ago to the Twin Cities, and you know, sort of have become the food voice here in this area of the country. And it's a very tough place to be in certain considerations, given my personality stripes, because I'm pretty blunt and I'm pretty outspoken, and in my blog,
my friends just call me hurtful, by the way.
I talk about, you know, restaurant death watch. Here's who's dying now on the vine, and I get more angry hate mail about that. And you know, it's
can I tell you something, Andrew?
Yeah,
I know that you've been in the restaurant business for a long time. If you ever wrote that about one of my restaurants, I would hate you.
Yeah, you have to kill me, right?
I would come to Minneapolis, I would find you, and I would hate you.
When customers play that game, we all play that speculation game, because we've all been in those dining rooms where the body, Elio Guadalini, who owns Elio's in New York City and you know, one of the major icons in my early restaurant life in New York when I was an up-and-coming chef in the city in the early 80s, he used to tell me all the time that there are restaurants that are dead, but they don't even know it yet.
Yeah.
You know, and we all know in this business it's so tough. Science, a smart move is trying to figure out how to close your doors, and we have restaurants here that are dying on the vines, gasping for air, and people are wondering why that's the case. And I think that writing about that is illustrative of larger problems and of cultural taste swings in this part of the world. And I think it's important that we talk about them. I'm not trying to make friends with the restaurant owners in those cases. And most of the good places, quite frankly, when they're facing a decline, when the body is sick, they're taking steps to kind of cure it.
You know, I think that one of the interesting things about the restaurant business, and I know that you've done restaurant consulting, and Mark and I do restaurant consulting, and a sad situation is sometimes you're in a restaurant and you say, listen, I know that you've owned this restaurant. Because, you know, it is the last bastion of mom and pops. And you say, listen,
right.
I know that you've owned this restaurant for 10 years. And we own our own restaurant. So it would be a terrible heartbreak if we had to close one of our restaurants. But you get to a point where it's an individual. And they're going further and further into debt. And very often these small business people have put their houses up and their
right.
personal assets up. And you want to say, listen, close it now. Lose $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Don't keep it open for a year and lose $450,000.
That's right. And the heartbreaker is that there are people attached to these things.
Yeah.
And phenomenal life stories, because that's what makes our business so great, is the people that are in it. And I always tell folks, when you know friends call me or I'm having an off the record conversation with a restaurant owner, I said, you know, the faster you pull the plug on this, is the sooner that you can go and do something else that's going to work.
Yeah.
Because if you literally bleed out the animal, there's no reviving anything.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah.
And Andrew, when we come back, I want to talk about the 10 funniest minutes I've seen on television this year.
I think Andrew was involved. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, a Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. And our guest is Andrew Zimmern of Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern.
So, Andrew, last week I'm watching The Tonight Show, and you're one of the guests on The Tonight Show with Jay. And are you aware that one of your eels chased Felicity Huffman off stage?
You know,
shriekingly.
While it was happening, I thought to myself, and, you know, thoughts happen in the blink of an eye. I had the technically not to, you know, you're hosting me here. I'm a guest. Technically, it was a South Korean hagfish, which makes an eel look pretty. It has this mouth with these sort of daggers that it latches onto things, and when it feels scared, it leeches about a softball-sized clump of Vaseline out of its skin as a defense mechanism.
Which you were kind enough to show us at the on the show.
And when I saw one of these things get out and slither its way towards the gracious, the kind, the elegant Oscar-nominated actress of Transamerica fame and one of the co-stars of Desperate Housewives, I almost had a heart attack, and I thought to myself, no, wait a second, this is going to be great TV. And then I saw the legitimate fear in her eyes, and when she got up and ran off the set, I had to control myself. And when Jay chimed in with, what are you doing with the pillow in your hand? But, yeah, they started to get out of the little square aquarium that the Tonight Show staff had boxed these things in. Anytime you can bring a live animal and onto a TV show like that, and then eat a cooked version of it in front of itself, the animals get ticked off.
Yeah,
you can't blame them, can you?
I would. You know what's funny though is they also try to get even because while we were going to eat some of its brothers, it was trying to eat her. You know, and I think that's sort of sporting of you, actually, Andrew. Don't you think it's
in a certain sense? Yes, I once tried to feed an ostrich grilled ostrich meat when I came face to face with it, and it pecked me on the head. So I think my self-imposed cannibalism, you know, moments with animals are dead and gone. But the Tonight Show can't wait to have me back.
So that was the first case of mad ostrich disease, I guess.
Yes. I learned something very scary about ostriches. They're more dangerous than lions. They hunt down tigers and lions in the desert and eviscerate them.
We're gonna leave that as a cliffhanger and find out exactly how that's done and how you know that right after the news. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Andrew Zimmern is a food writer, dining columnist, and restaurant critic. You may not have known that, but you probably do know him from his show on the Travel Channel, Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern, which airs Monday evenings at 9, where he scares even the likes of us with the kinds of things he puts into his mouth. So, Andrew, I just have to touch on something we talked about before the news. We left people with a cliffhanger. You said that ostriches hunt down, like, lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Ostriches are one of the most dangerous animals in the world. They can run. I think they're one of the third or fourth fastest animal in the world. And the way that ostriches kill their prey is they actually run them down. And these include animals like ibex and certain jungle cats and things like that. They run them down in the open soft sand desert. And what they're able to do is exhaust the animal, right, to the point where their prey is just thin and slow. And most people have never seen an ostrich's foot. They have a dagger of a talon on the edge of their foot that's about 11 or 12 inches curved and razor sharp. And what these animals, the ostriches, do is they eviscerate their animals with one blow and let them just bleed to death. And then once they're dead, they peck at them and eat them. And so I thought it would be funny, since most people don't know that ostriches are carnivorous in that sense, to feed an ostrich some grilled ostrich meat at one point when I was doing a pilot 3 or 4 years ago, and the ostrich got really ticked off at me.
He thought of it as less funny, I guess.
Much less funny, and he pecked at my head, and it hurt, and immediately several handlers got really, really nervous, and I sort of stepped out of this pen area where I was with the ostrich, because I couldn't hear what these people were screaming at me, and I'm glad I didn't, because it saved me from panicking. But they were telling me to get out of there, because they were worried that this thing was going to flay me open. Ostrich are very dangerous animal, but delicious to eat.
And you know,
luckily, we are very dangerous animals as well.
Yeah, but the ostrich was looking at you thinking, he bet he's delicious to eat.
Very yummy. Very, very yummy.
Well, now, let's bring us to the topic of your show.
Sure.
Which is brilliant, and you know it's a subject that we've touched upon a number of different times in a number of different categories. We had a guy named Stephen Witherly, who is a food scientist and researcher, and talks about why we taste certain things. Mm-hmm. And we found a lot from him about tastes that are universal, like vanilla is cross culturally universal. Our brains are sort of hardwired as human beings.
Yep.
To like vanilla and never get tired of vanilla. It doesn't matter our culture. But other things are very cultural. You know,
yeah.
A third or two-thirds of the world's population gets some of its nutrition from insects. Yet in our culture, we're revolted by the idea
of eating ants.
What prompted you to sort of challenge our Western notions of what to eat on TV? It's been a runaway success, but where'd the idea come from?
I was eating around the world since I was a little kid. And it always amazed me, and I wish I could tell you that I had the idea first to do it, but it didn't. Like, I think, like many good things, sort of like Newton with the apple, it was a perfect storm of circumstance. But essentially, what happened to me was I finally had enough experience being in other cultures, eating foods that in our American culture we're predisposed culturally and psychologically not to want to try, yet in place of origin, everyone is eating it. And what really got me sunk was the converse experience, where I was in a jungle market in northern Thailand, and I was trying to describe that someone was trying to get me to eat something that was just horrifying. It was, you know, some sort of like putrefied sheep guts thing that just was spoiled, and I wanted the fresh, you know, mountain sheep guts from the guy who had the couple of leaves down.
Of course,
the,
who
down
do they
the
think you were
from him? And,
think you're some goat herder or something?
Right. And it occurred to me that cheese in our country, which was getting, you know, so popular, I mean, this is 10 years ago at the dawning of the cheese revolution, it occurred to me that if you tried to explain cheese to a Kalahari tribes person, that they would laugh at you, that we take milk, you know, spoil it, let it dry into little squares and rounds, and eat that.
Well, wait till
and,
it molds. Some a lot of them, you got to wait till till it molds.
And you know, cheese is just controlled spoilage. What most people think of as ripening fruit is actually rotting fruit. You know, ripening is what happens when the apple is still on the tree. Rotting is what happens once it's picked. It's just a slow process that we sort of have managed to trap at certain stages so that we can enjoy it. And it really is a matter of perspective and definition. So I married that idea with the notion of taking people into food cultures and places that they've never seen or thought of before. I was so sick and tired of watching talking heads standing behind a cutting board talking about yet another way to, you know, oven roast cherry tomatoes. And I thought, you know, there is a world of, if people are really interested in food, let's go to Taiwan and eat stinky tofu. Let's go to Vietnam and eat, you know, patty crab soup. You know, let's go into Alaska in our own backyard and eat ptarmigan, or New Orleans and eat nutria, or Mississippi and eat raccoon and possum.
Hold on a second. You got to go back to Alaska and tell us what that means and what that is, and then you got to go to New Orleans and tell us what that means and what that is, because I can't even pronounce it.
Well, we were in Alaska, and I'm up on the Skookum ice field, and we don't have any lunch with us, and I asked the guides, each of whom has three or four different guns bungee corded to the cowling of their snowmobiles. They call them snow machines, actually, up there. And they pointed to the ptarmigans in the trees and said, "You're looking at it." And the ptarmigans weren't moving from these, well, they're really bushes that they were sort of hiding in. Because
you're going to have
to define ptarmigan, please.
Yep.
Ptarmigan is like an Arctic pigeon.
Oh.
Delicious.
Sounds great.
Yeah,
okay.
It's squab. Mm-hmm. That's really all it is. It lives up there.
It's a cold squab, though.
It could vary. But it has a lot of fat content in it because it lives in the Arctic Circle area. And so, you know, we shot some ptarmigan and roasted them up on the Skookum ice field. It was heavenly. Now, it was a lot better than the moose nose jelly that I'd had that morning, which is basically head cheese made with the head of a moose. But in a place where you have to eat everything that you come across.
Hold on one second again. I'm sorry, you're going too fast. See the moose nose jelly?
Yes.
I got a slightly different picture. Okay, about what?
Everyone does. I asked the Yupik Eskimos that I was with, I said, who came up with this name? And no one could tell me. It's really just head cheese. But, you know, when the first line in the recipe is quarter your moose head and boil it in 4 gallons of water, you've got an interesting recipe. Nutria down in New Orleans is, I mean, everyone down in the South knows nutria. It's a giant aquatic water rodent that is a pest. More than anything else, it's destroying the floating carpet that really is the bayou, the maton.
I was going to say, can we call it a rat?
It is a rat. It's a water rat.
Okay, that's...
But it's delicious. It's delicious. I mean, you know, guinea pig in Ecuador, I mean, that's the barbecue, you know, as ribs and burgers are to many of the, you know, food pathways in this country, so is guinea pig or cuy to the Ecuadorians and Peruvians. And once you're there to explore the whys and the wherefores, I think makes for fabulous television, and the people that you meet on these trips is worth the price of admission. It's a great show. I'm glad you like it.
Well, let me ask you, what of the things in your travels, because, you know, you start to do this because you have a propensity for it, and you're able to take a broader view of things and sort of put yourself outside of your own cultural boundaries and try and look at things objectively and experience them that way. But once you become the expert in this, people start to, and Bourdain said this too, once you start to have the, you know, iron stomach, people sort of challenge you and bring it to the ultimate, you know,
sure.
You become the target, you know.
Yep.
You're the biggest guy in the room that everybody wants to pick a fight with. What have you had, or have you had many experiences where you've come across stuff where you're like, that's just disgusting, I can't eat that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tony and I often joke that the worst part of our two jobs is that you're the honored guest in a lot of cultures, where to be the honored guest means you get the one piece on the animal that nobody else really wants to eat. And, you know, when a guy hands you the, you know, the broiled, you know, warthog spleen, you know, and
the monkey
nice,
fingernails.
Yeah, and it's nice and medium rare, and you just wish they could clean it a little before they cooked it, and you might eat it. It gets a little goofy. You know, there's been a couple foods that I haven't been able to keep down just because they're just, you know, too strange for a Western palate, and I have a very, very open-minded Western palate. But there are foods that I avoid. I mean, there you do get certain encephalitic diseases from eating brains of certain animals in certain countries where they're tainted, so you got to be very careful.
What?
I try to avoid unwashed or uncooked intestines, simply because there's too much disease in there that might compromise my system. Other than that, I've not found anything that I've refused. My motto is sort of, you know, try it twice. But there's been famously, stinky tofu in Taiwan. The stuff that's on the streets is sweet and delicious, and it's two-day stink on it. I tried some stuff at Dai's House of Unique Stink, which I think is the best restaurant name I've ever
heard.
That
is easily the best restaurant name in the world.
In the world. And they have a 14-day-old tofu that basically sits in an oceanic green sludge and ferments that is the foulest thing I've ever put into my system. I just couldn't get it down. It just tasted too putrid.
The mother sludge, as it were.
The mother sludge. I will tell you right now, stinky tofu on the streets of Taiwan, stuffed with cabbage and sprinkled with white pepper and chilies, is as good as food gets. But don't let anybody talk you into a Taiwanese hamburger at Dai's House of Unique Stink.
Ooh, back in just a moment to find out what exactly would be in that Taiwanese hamburger. I'm frightened. I need to take a break and gather myself together. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1146.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Andrew Zimmern of Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern, which you can see on the Travel Channel. Find out more about it from our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Andrew, we were talking about a South Vietnamese hamburger, stinky hamburger.
Taiwanese.
Tell me about this.
Well, the restaurant is called Dai's House of Unique Stink, and they make everything with 14-day-old stinky tofu. And it's sort of like stink heads in Alaska, the fish that are rolled in hay and just allowed to ferment. The idea with certain foods and certain cultures is that they let it putrefy to the point where the bad bacteria grows to a poisonous ratio, and then the bad bacteria basically eats itself and the good bacteria is left behind. And so it's not pathogenic in a harmful way, but what it is it leaves that wonderful putrefied food flavor that in the West we're taught is a non-edible thing. Don't put it into your system. Your brain shuts off, your throat closes, and your tongue tells you, spit it out, spit it out, spit it out.
Okay, that's not just in the West. My dog knows not to eat stuff like that, okay?
So I'm in Dai's House of Unique Stink, and the proprietress, the tofu meister there, says to me, you got to try this thing. She calls it a Taiwanese hamburger. And what it is it's sliced pieces of stomach, tripe, the stomach lining. And it's braised, not braised enough. It's a little tough. And she piles it and in between two halves of a tofu square that have been deep fried.
I need to interject that tripe may be my least favorite food on the planet.
Yeah, when it's there, I've had it about 100 times, and only two or three times have I had it done well enough that I would want to order it again.
So go ahead.
Yeah, and the tofu square, you know, at the local Chinese restaurant or Japanese restaurant, they deep fry the tofu and they stick it as a garnish on things or in stir fries or in a soup or something. It's quite delightful. Here, it's a giant square, about 4 inches by 4 inches and about 1 inch high. She deep fries the whole thing. It's lost all its moisture. It's a very firm square because it's been putrefying for 14 days. She cuts it in half after it's been deep fried, and she puts the tripe in between. And it was, you get it up to your face, and I was able to get my teeth around it and sink them in. And when I inhaled in that way that you taste things on the back of your tongue, I couldn't do it. I could not even force myself to swallow it. Now, I'd already tried the raw 14-day-old tofu, and I had to squeeze down a gumball-sized nugget of it. So I had the experience of being able to taste it and had some ability to say, no, this isn't for me.
And your stomach knew what was coming.
Absolutely. And it was just terrible. And all the next 24 hours, I was on the illness watch, because I thought, if anything is going to get me, it's going to be this stuff. But luckily, and, filming 13, 14 one-hours of these shows, I've still yet to have a day or a night of discomfort, which, knock on wood, is something I won't have to experience if I keep choosing wisely.
By the way, I've picked bad fast food restaurants and had a night of discomfort, so you're doing pretty well.
I always tell the crew that's with me is always eating the sliced tomato salad at the hotel, and I always tell them, you're going to get sick, and I'm not. I mean, I won't eat that stuff.
Right, they don't know how to handle that.
Yeah, I use the New York, New Jersey hot dog school of food selection. And what that is you're on a street corner. On the other three street corners are three hot dog guys. Two are cold, lonely, miserable, and nobody is buying a hot dog. The fourth corner has the third hot dog stand on it. There's a line down the block. Everyone's happy and convivial. Big wafts of steam every time he opens up the little silver trays that have his griddled onions in there. And you go and you buy a hot dog from that guy. It's a no-brainer. That guy's got good food. And whether you're in the back alleys of Beijing or the jungle markets of Thailand, you use the exact same logic stream to select your, grilled wild boar intestine, and you're going to be fine.
You know, it's funny. I had a very similar experience, and I had the first time I took the guy who's now the sommelier for our organization. We went to Paris, and we stopped in Paris before we went on a little wine-buying trip. And we were walking through the streets of Paris, and I said, that one right there. That's and there's a bread bakery on every corner in Paris, and there was one, and it was 5 o'clock, and I said, that's the one. He's like, but there's a line down the street. I said, exactly. There is a line down the street. Hey, I have a question for you. Every time I look at your show, I see similarities with another show that's on television. It strikes me you would be an excellent contestant on Fear Factor.
My wife is a former world champion water skier, and she was the top of the pyramid at SeaWorld for a year on the water ski team, and she could do all the acrobatic helicopter stuff because she doesn't get scared by those kinds of things.
And you can eat the bugs.
And I can eat the bugs, and sadly, they have no interest in having me on the show. I want to do that, and I want to do the Great Race, but I don't think anybody has me interested. Hey, I've got a proposal for you, though.
Okay.
Since you guys are such great eaters, we have a brand-new promotion at TravelChannel.com. If you go onto the website and click on me on Bizarre Foods, folks can write in about the most bizarre foods they've eaten and where they are. So it's a chance for your audience to get involved in the Bizarre Food Sweepstakes. It's a lot of fun. I think your listeners would enjoy checking it out.
Well, and we're going to do that. We're going to link to that site, to that place on your site through our site, restaurantguysradio.com.
Delightful.
And we encourage people to go check it out. Hey, Andrew Zimmern, it's been tremendous talking with you.
Really a lot of fun.
And likewise, guys. We've got to get you on my show next. I know you're really busy, but we'd love to have you.
There's always a little bit of time, you know that.
Always,
I appreciate it.
Always for fellow foodies.
I appreciate it.
We'll be back in just a moment. You have to check out Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern on the Travel Channel Monday evenings at 9. You can find out all about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, talking today with Andrew Zimmern.
So I have a story about someone who was in the restaurant, and this actually happened to me, maybe 3-4 nights ago, but it happens fairly frequently. People come into the restaurant, and they say things to me like, I can't listen to your show anymore.
Why?
And that's what, why can't you listen to my show? You don't like my show? No, I love your show. But as soon as I turn it off, I have to run and go eat something.
I don't think today's show is going
to
be that way.
I think today was a lesson to all those people who've been saying to me and to you, young lady, the other night, who said you're not going to listen to my show anymore. You can listen now. We've designed a show to disgust you about food. So we hope that worked for you today. The show is crazy. He eats some fairly, for me to say he's eating crazy things, means he's eating crazy things.
Well, but the other thing is, I think one of the things we have to give him a lot of credit for is it's not just it's not Fear Factor. He's not doing it on a dare. I think he's making a point, and he's showing us that a lot of our what we find disgusting and what we find delicious is often culture bound.
And we have preconceived notions about certain foods that they're not going to be good, because that's what our notion is. A lot of these things obviously are acquired taste. I mean, stinky tofu, I think you work your way up from slightly stinky tofu over a period of a lifetime to, you know, Dan's House of Stinky Tofu. Or
not me. Not me.
Well, not this lifetime.
Sometimes.
Maybe my next one.
Sometimes I'm just culture bound, and I feel all comfortable in my bound in my culture. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the rest of this hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.